want the Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
I am grateful to the many listeners who subscribe voluntarily to support the Peter B. Collins Show. You can do it too. Just log on to my website at peterbcollins.com. Your voluntary subscription starts as low as $5 a month. And my thanks today to Larry Doers, who listens online from the sunny climes of Costa Rica, where he is a proud expatriate of the United States. In a moment, we're going to talk about a potential conflict of interest on the part of California's senior Senator Dianne Feinstein. The story broke in early December, published in the San Francisco Chronicle. And intrepid investigative journalist Lance Williams is here in my secret studio today. Lance, good to talk with you again.
Happy to be here, Peter.
And you've made a change since the last time we talked. We were talking about shield laws for journalists, about your coverage of the Barry Bonds case, together with your writing partner, Mark Fenaru-Wada. And at one point, you were facing, 18 months in federal prison on a contempt charge. So you know about the exposure that reporters can sometimes be subject to. You left the San Francisco Chronicle, as many of these publications have downsized recently and shed reporters. You left in August of this year, and you're now working at California Watch. Tell us about California Watch.
Sure, Peter. California Watch is a project of the Center for Investigative Reporting in Berkeley, which is a foundation-funded journalism enterprise dedicated to doing investigations. And the project we're here to talk about was my first one at the center and happened to wind up on page one of my old paper, so it's all good.
Yeah. Well, I also want to reference your great work at the what used to be a great newspaper, the San Francisco Examiner. It lives on in a different form under a different owner. But you were there back in the day when Bronstein, before he and you and many others moved over to the Chronicle, when Hearst bought the morning paper. But that was a scrappy afternoon paper, struggling for survival. You had that weird Sunday combined edition, which was where you really got to reach a lot of readers. And you did a lot of great work there at the X.
Well, thanks so much. I had so much fun at the Examiner. It was really, really just a reporter's paper, and with few of the responsibilities that the big AM paper had to assume, we were just out there chasing stories, so it was really fun.
You've been chasing stories for a long time, haven't you?
I wish I would grow up, but I guess I'm not gonna.
Now, tell us how this works with California Watch, because in some ways it appears that you are taking over the enterprise journalism and investigative efforts that used to be the province of daily papers like your former employer.
Well, we think there's a need that we can fill, although the papers are still doing enterprise work and doing their own investigations and so forth. It's undeniable that every paper in California is cut way back just because of the economic climate we're all in. And California Watch and the Center are there to provide high-quality investigative work and partner with these traditional media outlets and try to get the job done. We're collaborative rather than competitive. Now, that's hard for an old PM newspaper guy to get used to, but mm-hmm. There we are. We will work with anybody and do stuff for anybody and really just want to get the information out there.
Now, the story we're about to discuss regards a very powerful senior senator here in California, Dianne Feinstein, former mayor of San Francisco, very well connected in political and business circles. And I'm just curious, do you think you could have done this same story at the Chronicle as recently as when you left in August?
Yeah, I do. I think if I had stayed at the Chronicle, I would have continued to do stories like I had been doing. The main difference in my work situation was that for years we had had an investigative reporting team, and they couldn't afford that anymore, and they did fold it up. And I was tasked to do investigations for them, and so I would have probably been doing my same stuff. I mean, the advantage personally for me going to the center is I'm back in an I-team environment with other investigative reporters, and it's just a little more synergy when you're working with other people trying to do the same kind of stuff you are.
Mm-hmm. The reason I raise it is a few years ago, the Nation Institute funded, and I can't recall the reporter's name right now, but he's from Sonoma County, and he did a deep investigation into Senator Feinstein, her husband's business interests, where some of their philanthropy goes, and exactly, you know, where all that leads. And ultimately, the Nation spiked the story. They paid for the investigation. They had green-lighted the story. And when it was published, apparently it stepped on a few too many toes. And so they said, well, she just got reelected, so we're going to just put this on the shelf for now.
Well, not knowing what he had, it's got to be a frustrating experience. The Chronicle has published tough things about Senator Feinstein from time to time. When we were at the Examiner, we held her up to appropriate scrutiny from time to time. I mean, she's a extremely connected, extremely powerful California official, and you know, you have to look at what they do. It's a reporter's job.
Mm-hmm. Tell us who Stuart Resnick is.
Yeah, Mr. Resnick is one of the wealthiest men in Los Angeles, and he's well known for his philanthropy. He's given many millions to hospitals and other good causes down there. He also owns more ag property than perhaps anyone in the state, 120,000 or so acres of heavily irrigated farmland down, most of it in Kern County, down by Bakersfield. And
that's where the Chandler family used to have huge agricultural interests, right? They owned the Los Angeles Times for many years.
And if you're going to do that, if you're going to farm down there, you need water.
Yes, so, you do.
And so Mr. Resnick has made himself an important player in California water politics, not particularly well known, and that's probably just as well as far as he's concerned. But he's given many thousands of dollars to California politicians, and from time to time he's exerted influence over public policy decisions that he'd like to see come out the way he'd like to see them come out.
And as you point out, water politics have been part of California really since the gold rush. And I think for people outside the state, things are often oversimplified. For example, Sean Hannity parachuted in with the Fox News cameras to the Central Valley a couple of months ago. And despite all of the complexities of the issue, he just boiled it down to farmers need more water, turn on the water. And there are complex issues related to the ecosystem of the San Francisco and Sacramento River Delta region, the diversion of that water to Central and Southern California agriculture interests, and its impact on both drinking water supplies in the North State and on fisheries. And the salmon runs along the Sacramento system have dropped to catastrophic low levels. The Delta smelt is defined as an endangered species, and these little critters get caught up in the massive pumps that are used to transit water from the North State to the Central and Southern regions. And that's just really scratching the surface. These are very complicated issues, and what has happened recently is there's been a real struggle. We saw that Vice President Cheney himself got involved in water issues in the Klamath Basin, favoring farmers over fish and people. And so these are very sensitive issues. We saw that Governor Schwarzenegger had to call a special session of the California legislature to wrestle over water issues. And while I don't fully understand the package that they put out, it's expensive. It's got a big component of pork. And it also does appear to offer an opportunity for a new peripheral canal, which, again, would divert Northern California water to Central and Southern California. So what I'm trying to achieve there is for people who aren't familiar with our issues, that they're very complex. There are many different interest groups with legitimate demands on this natural resource. And what you have reported is that Senator Feinstein intervened at a critical stage in the discussion of these policies after she received a letter from Mr. Resnick. Tell us more about that.
Sure. Well, Senator Feinstein and Mr. Resnick are social friends. They both have second homes in Aspen, and he's been a donor to her for years, not perhaps as generous to her as he's been to candidates for governor, but still he's a regular contributor, and he has, you know, what we call access, I suppose. And in this, you know, competition, as you describe it, between the ag interests who want to pump more water during a drought and the environmental advocates who want to preserve and try to rebuild that shattered ecosystem in the Sacramento Delta, he wanted her to weigh in on the side of farmers, and it got a little technical. He wanted her to commission another scientific study of whether the plans that the federal wildlife agencies had just put into effect to try to rebuild the fisheries in the Delta by cutting back on the water available for irrigation. And I suppose what was interesting about the dynamic is he put his request in writing and she forwarded it to two U.S. cabinet secretaries along with her own letter, citing Mr. Resnick's letter by name and saying she wanted to spend $750,000 on new environmental studies. And even though the administration had been reluctant or refused to do this when Governor Schwarzenegger requested it, when the senior senator from California, a Democrat, wanted it too, they said, okay. And so now we're going to restudy something that was, oh, shucks, just studied. I mean, the latest Revive the Delta plan just went into effect within the last year.
So we need to study this until we get an outcome that is satisfactory to the senator and her benefactor?
Yeah, I mean, the farmers would like the scientists to conclude that the fisheries are in collapse because of all sorts of urban effects on the Delta, you know, runoff from factories, sewer plants, and so forth. And they would like the scientists to conclude that it really isn't about the volume of water available for the fish. The environmentalists and the federal agencies concluded that they need to preserve or hold back water for fishery purposes, especially at key times in the fisheries life cycle. I mean, it gets technical, but that's where the lines are drawn. And yeah, the senator would weigh in on the side of the farmers and her financial benefactor and social friend.
And Lance, just a quick sidebar here. Farmers' agribusiness interests already enjoy preferences in access to water supplies in California to begin with. For example, there is the Central Valley Project, which collects large amounts of water and delivers it to, and I use this term agribusiness to try to separate the mom-and-pop farm growing strawberries in Watsonville from these huge operations like Resnick's Paramount Farms with 118,000 acres. That's a huge mechanized factory farming kind of business. And they get cheap water from the Central Valley Project by the acre foot. So it appears that their thirst knows no limits.
Well, it's a business. It's not Walter Brennan in The Real McCoys, if you're that old. Mr. Resnick is not a farmer at all. He's a businessman who happened to buy real estate in the 70s as a hedge on inflation and just went for it. He's got a really sophisticated farming operation, state-of-the-art in many respects. And I would argue, although he doesn't, he has a very sophisticated political operation as well. Donations to officials that have sway over matters that affect agribusiness's bottom line. That's where he donates his money, by and large.
And if people use their favorite search engine and enter California Watch, you can get a link to the website at the Center for Investigative Reporting, where not only your article appears, but also some of the supporting documentation. And up on our computer screen here, Lance, we have a list of the Resnick contributions, and this appears to go back well into the 1990s. Pete Wilson, the former Republican governor, received about $238,000 over the course of his political career. The current governor, Schwarzenegger's, gotten just shy of $300,000. Gray Davis scooped up a lot of cash from him, the governor who was recalled, $643,000. And when you went and talked to Stuart Resnick, he seemed fuzzy, for example, couldn't quite recall that he had supported Pete Wilson. Now, predominantly, this list is Democrats, but there's here's the Republican National Committee for what's is that $59,000. So he does spread his money around selectively or strategically, I would say.
Yes, it's a common pattern with smart business interests. You have to deal with whoever's in power, and so you try to hedge your bets. And Mr. Resnick, I think, is a Democrat. His wife's, I think he says, more left than he is. And they give to a lot of Democrats, but they give to Republicans. They contribute generally to Valley politicians, governors, and then issues that are of interest to them in Los Angeles as well, which is where they actually reside, up in Beverly Hills.
Mm-hmm. And did you see him as somewhat detached from his political giving, or was that a convenience on his part?
Well,
I'm trying to think of a diplomatic way of describing it.
Yeah, well, he was kind enough to spend some time and talk about it. Not everybody does for a story like this, and I give him a lot of credit for that. But the people who have encountered Paramount Farms in Sacramento say that it is a really smart, really savvy political operation, that there's nothing haphazard about where the money goes or how they think strategically. And he would, I suppose, in a sort of a self-deprecating way, wanted to portray himself as a guy who just gave money. His wife often tells him who to give to, and there's no real pattern to it. Bless his heart.
Mm-hmm. And the amounts of money involved in terms of his direct contributions to Senator Feinstein are relatively small. What, about $29,000 over her three terms as a senator? And part of that is that she hasn't really needed to raise large amounts of money. The Republicans have not fielded a real significant opponent for her over these three election cycles. And so you also do point out, though, that they gave some money to her Political Action Committee Fund for the Majority, and also large amounts to Democratic Party campaign accounts that could have gone to Feinstein or could have been designated by her to other Democratic campaigns, which is how they trade that money around in Washington.
Yeah, we looked at years in which the senator was up for reelection and looked at his donation to the party committees, and it was significant. It was several hundred thousand dollars. He's hosted at least one big fundraising soiree for that we know of during one of the Democratic National Conventions. And they're social friends, as we say. And I guess, Peter, I don't think this was necessarily cash and carry at all, but I think that's an example of how you get access to a powerful official and how a powerful official may react when you've gotten access.
Mm-hmm.
Few of us would have hopes of writing a plea to our senator and having her come to bat for us in the way that she did for Mr. Resnick. And I assume that that personal relationship and those donations had to play a part in the dynamic.
Well, and you have helped us through this investigation understand why she surprised so many people and called for this additional study. Because it appeared that we were very close to resolving these issues, and now all of a sudden a further delay and the expense is not that substantial, less than $1 million, Resnick could write that check himself and probably expedite the process. The issue is, though, that it appears to be a way of trying to get science to match the interests of Mr. Resnick's agribusiness holdings.
Right, and we got mad during President Bush's terms at attempts by the Republicans to jigger scientific information to get us to predetermined ends, and looks like we can all do that when we're advocating a cause we personally believe is right.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you have a chance to read the senator's letter to the Chronicle, which was published on Wednesday, December 9th? And she goes into some detail, but she doesn't really attempt to refute the idea that money equals access.
Well, I'm familiar with the letter. It's similar to the information her spokesman provided us. She certainly is strongly contends that what she did was in the best interest of California, and that the Central Valley needs relief, and that there might be something wrong with the science. And golly, there really is a particularly fierce effect of the recession in some of the valley towns where unemployment is way high. And it's true that when the water is cut back for irrigation, some of the farmers can't plant, and that has impact on employment as well. So those are some of her points.
But what's left out here is, again, what I alluded to earlier, that agriculture already has huge preferences in access to water, and they also squander a lot of water because the rice farming, for example, that is very water intensive and leaves that water laced with pesticides, including selenium. This occurs mostly north of Sacramento, but the residue from it flows down into the river system. And if we saw the people like Resnick, who control a lot of these large farming operations, tighten up their usage before they demanded access to additional supply, I think people might be a little more sympathetic.
Well, we've been fighting about water, as you say, since the gold rush, and these are simply arguments that one side uses and the other side comes back with their own, and you can wring your hands about resolving some of these things.
Mm-hmm. Now, I can almost see DiFi waving a finger as I read this part of her letter. I forwarded Stuart Resnick's letter to the Interior and Commerce Department because it articulated the view I heard from Valley farmers, many of whom run small family operations. I have known Mr. Resnick and his wife for many years, but if I did not think the Academy of Sciences review was in the best interests of California, I would not advocate for it. Stop. Period. Stop. Now, that's a very strong statement from a woman who, as I say, I can even imagine her inflecting those words. Is that the whole story?
Well, if you overlay the issues we wrote about, then you have the whole story. You know, if you overlay the donations and the social relationship and so forth. And really, we were just trying to describe the complete dynamic here. If it's okay for these guys to do this stuff, it ought to be okay to write about it factually.
Mm-hmm. Do you think the senator is excessively sensitive?
Well, Senator Feinstein cares what people think about her. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just know that from writing stories over the years. Other officials may have thicker hides or at least are less responsive in the way that she is. But, you know, it's part of her personality. And, you know, there's I'm sure, a positive side to that, too. It's great that she cares what people think. Great that she is as responsive as she is.
Well, if you'll indulge me, I'll tell a little story from 1992. Your colleague at the time, John Jacobs, was the political editor of The Examiner. And he and I and the news director from the San Francisco television station KPIX, Channel 5, organized a series. We didn't call them debates, but these were joint appearances by the large field of candidates. We had unusually two Senate seats open that year. And Feinstein, who had just come off a losing run for governor against Pete Wilson, was very intent on managing her participation in this event. And in particular, as we got close to the day where we were going to broadcast this on radio and TV, and the it would be covered in the Sunday paper the following day, a flurry of phone calls came from Ms. Feinstein. And she was objecting to the ground rules that had been established for participation, and in particular that one of the fringe Democratic candidates, Joe Alioto Jr., had been excluded. And he had been excluded because he didn't meet the test of 5% support statewide in a recent poll. And I guess we had a couple of other criteria. And so she kept pushing, saying that, you know, she didn't care what the criteria were, that she just thought this was so grossly unfair, and that she was stomping her feet and calling your boss, Phil Bronstein, and complaining, and the general managers of the TV and radio stations. And so on the day of the event, I somehow was asked to escort her husband to the green room where she was having makeup applied and getting ready. And as I entered the room, she said, "Oh, you're the one who wouldn't let Joe Alioto participate." And I said, "Well, Mayor Feinstein, that's not really the case." And I explained the criteria and all that. And then she looked at me and she said, "Would you want to be alone on the set with Gray Davis?"
That's a great story.
And that appeared to be the motivation, because Davis's campaign, 2 weeks before that, had released a TV spot where they compared Feinstein to Leona Helmsley, the hotel baroness and...
You know, Senator Feinstein isn't the only person who felt that way about Gray Davis. But I never felt that way.
And just to complete the anecdote, Ana Chavez was a news anchor from Channel 7, and she surprised Davis and Feinstein with a trick question. She asked them to tell her what the price of a gallon of milk was. And neither one of them had a clue. Diane thought it was about three times more than the current price, and Davis said, "Oh, my wife buys the milk."
That's pretty funny. That's pretty funny.
Well, Lance, I want to thank you for joining us today, and thanks for this investigative piece. What are you working on next?
Well, you know, I never talk about what I'm working on. I always talk about what I've just finished, but we're looking at California-related issues, and we do have a project going on stimulus spending in California, mm-hmm. seeing how that is. So
I haven't gotten any, so you can move on.
Well, shucks, you're just not living right.
Well, I don't have a shovel-ready project. I do all my shoveling behind the microphone here. I can't let you go without an update on the Barry Bonds investigation and the powerful book that you wrote called Game of Shadows.
Well, we're all hanging around waiting for the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal to decide how much evidence they're going to let in to the Home Run Kings perjury trial, which has been on hold since March. The trial judge tossed some positive steroid test results that federal investigators had in their possession. She said it was not admissible unless the tests were verified by the Home Run Kings weight trainer, who doesn't want to testify, and then it gets very thick. I suppose we'll get a ruling in the next month or so, and then maybe we'll get a trial date, or maybe the government will walk away from it. But we're now, I believe we're 6 years since the Balco raid, and maybe 8 years since many of the events the trial will cover took place. So it's you got to have a good memory to keep the story straight by now.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate all the work that you did on that and the risk that you put yourself and your co-journalist, Mark Fanaru-Wada, in. And I just want to ask you one more thing, and that is about the progress of a shield law in Washington. The last I saw was a very narrow piece of legislation that only applied to journalists who were on the payroll of a recognized news outlet or who had a written independent contract with them. And that leaves out all kinds of reporters, including bloggers. And I firmly believe that bloggers are journalists. Some of them may not measure up to our standards of taste or accuracy, but I think that they deserve the same protections as a staff member of a major daily or a broadcast television outlet. What do you know about the status of that proposal?
Actually, I do think that was a provision that Senator Feinstein wanted in the proposed SHIELD law, coincidentally to our discussion here, of course. And I'm sorry that they're parsing the bill in that way. You know, the real importance of the SHIELD law isn't to protect a class of reporters. It's to protect the information, the independent information available to citizens of the United States. They can know what their government's actually up to. And so the focus, I always thought, should be on in that direction rather than trying to decide which journalists are going to be entitled to claim the protection. You know, a better way to look at it is this person doing journalism, not whether they are a journalist. I mean, a blogger can be doing real fact-finding and real reporting. And if he or she is, they are entitled, I would think, to the same First Amendment protections as a staff writer for a newspaper. A blogger's not doing journalism. If they're doing something else, then the protection ought not apply. I think if you look at it that way, you can get to a right result better. But I do hope that our Congress can get a SHIELD law of some sort in place so we don't have a continued spectacle of journalists being threatened with prison for trying to write true stories about, well, in our case, baseball.
Now, what's your view of Josh Wolf? He is an independent, he now works for a newspaper, so he would qualify under the new SHIELD law. But at the time, he was sent to prison for contempt, and I believe he served longer than Judy Miller or any other journalist who was imprisoned for refusal to reveal sources. I regard him as a hero in most respects. I'm not sure of the underlying story that he was defending and protecting, but the rights that he asserted are rights that I support.
Well, I met Josh's mom when he was in prison. I felt tremendous sympathy for a young guy. He was like 23, 24, freelancer. All of a sudden got FBI agents on his front porch, no legal help at first, and almost before he knew what he was doing, he was incarcerated and found in contempt. So I thought the government looked very mean in that case, and I was deeply regretful he had to go through that. It wasn't a confidential source case that I could tell. Probably I wouldn't have even been in the dispute he was in. They wanted some
footage,
some photography, and you know, we worked at Hearst. The way we handled requests like that is if a law enforcement agency wanted a unpublished photography material, we'd print it in the paper or put it up on the website, and they could go look at it that way. But it was a terrible case and a terrible situation to put a young man in prison for months over something like that.
Well, and Lance, one of the things that really troubled me was that the underlying crime was the destruction of a San Francisco police car. And they made this a federal case by saying, well, the San Francisco Police Department receives federal funds. Now, there's no indication that federal funds bought the particular police car that was damaged or destroyed. And the fact that he had footage of individuals who may have been responsible for that, again, this is a petty local crime, a state crime at best, and did not qualify for federal prosecution, in my view, in any way.
Oh, don't get me started. The reason it was a federal crime was because they knew the kid would use the California SHIELD law if they went to the DA's office with it, the San Francisco police, that is, if the DA would have charged it at all. And so instead they did an end run around the local prosecutor, took it to the U.S. attorney, and I think to the U.S. attorney's office did itself no credit by accepting that case and convening a federal grand jury in that way, because it was really just to get the kid and blow up the state SHIELD law.
Mm-hmm.
That was too bad.
Yeah. Lance, thank you. It's always great to talk with you, and I appreciate the work you do.
Peter, thanks so much for the opportunity.
Lance Williams on the Peter B. Collins Show. Another great investigative journalist is going to join us here on the Peter B. Collins Show next. Our program is sponsored by the Organic Wine Company. Now that you're eating organic, it's time to drink organic. Try the fine earth-friendly wines imported by the Organic Wine Company since 1980. All you have to do is go to my homepage at peterbcollins.com and click on the link for a special introductory offer just in time for the holidays or any other special occasion. Ah, I wish I knew now.
Poor old Granddad, I laughed at all his words. I thought he was a bitter man. He spoke of women's ways. The trap you
back before Rod Stewart's Mod Bod was one of the people on the cover of People magazine all the time. His original group called Faces, and it's called Ooh La La. Jason Leopold returns to our program today. He's been a regular contributor for many years. He's the editor-at-large at truthout.org and the founding editor at the Public Record on the web at pubrecord.org. Jason, great to have you with us.
Good to be here, Peter, and I have to say that that is Ronnie Lane, one of my favorite songs of all time. On the top five when the, you know, I loved him when he was with Faces, but his solo work is great.
Yeah, it is a terrific song, and maybe in my top 20.
No, it's great.
It's hard to choose them all.
Good choice.
Well, I've got another tune that I'm going to treat your ears to in just a moment, but I wanted to set our agenda today. You've published a powerful piece about the health status of our troops in Afghanistan. And it's quite troubling. We're going to delve into that.
Sure.
Also, an article that you wrote following President Obama's December 1st speech committing more American troops to Afghanistan. And you have some breaking news about the ACLU and its very sharp comments on the record to date, the legal record of the Obama administration, particularly as it relates to the torture policies.
Exactly.
And before we dive into that, I do want to play this other tune because back in the 80s, I was fascinated by a band called The Stranglers from England, and I've collected just about everything they have, and this one set of spoof or satire songs is only available on the B-sides of vinyl records, and now you can find some of them in box sets, and I did find this particular song I'm going to play at iTunes, and it's written from the point of view of a Soviet soldier who was sent to Afghanistan. And this song is called Vladimir and the Beast.
Huh.
We won't quite get to the beast part because Vladimir confesses that he fell in love with a camel. But what I would like you to hear is his description of what life was like for Russian soldiers in Afghanistan in the 1980s.
Support for the liberation struggle of our comrades in Afghanistan was not viewed altogether unanimously by the local population. In fact, we were not allowed outside of the barracks unless we were in large armored groups. During our brief stay in Afghanistan, we had discovered some of the very few pleasures open to visitors to this desolate place. A local concoction called hashish was being increasingly used by our troops, and many of the helicopter gunship and tank crews, moreover, would smoke large chillums and joints before embarking on missions around the mountains surrounding Kabul. Every week, comrades who had fallen into the hands of the rebels would be found in various states of dismemberment around the camp. Those unlucky enough to be still alive were sent for rehabilitation to the German Democratic Republic, since this would prevent any undue alarm by our loved ones back home. The wisdom of this policy is evidence of our leaders' great care for their people.
The wisdom of this policy is evidence of our leaders' great care for their people, he says. And he talks about how the troops were smoking hash and other available inebriants that are locally grown there in Afghanistan.
Nice.
And while this is satirical, I hope that my listeners will turn it up, listen carefully on the earbuds, because the narrative there is a little obscured by the production. But what they're trying to do in this satirical fashion is talk about the true human cost of the soldiers who were dispatched to Afghanistan by the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
And many of them came back addicted to opium, badly psychologically affected. And one of the things that's kind of been scrubbed from the media reports of our own troops serving in Afghanistan is the impact of being in a place where drugs are widely available and very addictive drugs like opium and heroin.
Right.
And you have reported here, Jason, you open your story by citing candidate Barack Obama, who was decrying the treatment of a specific soldier when he was on the campaign trail in Greenville, South Carolina, just last year.
Yeah, it was a terrible case. And, it was a veteran of World War II, 89 years old, who was repeatedly denied PTSD claim benefits. And, just got the runaround from the, Veterans Administration.
And just a quick correction, he was from Greenville. The comments that Obama made were actually in Charleston, West Virginia, just to be 100% accurate.
Right. I believe I did say that in my story.
You said that. I screwed it up when I just introduced you.
But, it was a terrible case. And basically what happened was, after his final denial of benefits, the veteran shot himself outside of, the VA facility, put a gun to his head, and then just blew his brains out. And Obama, said that this is unacceptable. How can we allow this to happen in our country? It's absolutely unacceptable. And he's made some promises, and he's done some things that have certainly been positive when you compare it certainly with the Bush administration in how he will or how he has tried to overhaul the Veterans Administration. I started the story with this story and then worked into the fact that, while he has done, while he has taken many steps to fix a terribly broken system, his administration is struggling. This year is struggling terribly to try and, really tackle the enormous mental health crisis that is affecting our soldiers that are serving in Afghanistan and Iraq, and just the benefits backlog. And, the problem here is that, unfortunately, that bureaucratic red tape still exists. We have a president who now, by the way, there's going to be 100,000 troops. I'm just going to segue to Afghanistan for a moment, but there's going to be 100,000 troops in Afghanistan by the time this surge is complete. Now, half of those troops, will have been sent there by Obama. While he is making every effort to combat, whatever it is that's going on over there, because depending on who you talk to, there's either 100 Al-Qaeda members or things with the Taliban, certainly issues revolving around that seem to be, changing every day. We really don't know who we're actually fighting. But he hasn't done anything to prepare for this, for the returning veterans and what needs to be done to make sure that they get what they need. He's installed Eric Shinseki as Secretary of Veterans Affairs, as Senate confirmed him, and that's a positive. Tammy Duckworth as well, an Iraq veteran who lost both of her legs in Iraq, another positive. However, they are not moving quickly enough. And by the way, it's a crisis where they do need to move quickly. If he is going to, which he already has, send 30,000 troops to Afghanistan, he needs to do something, to fix this system that is broken beyond repair to some extent, and make sure that these veterans get the help that they need, particularly those who served in Iraq and Afghanistan. There have been, Peter, since the start of the invasion of Afghanistan back in 2001, 1.9 million veterans who have or soldiers who have been deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, out of that 1.9 million, you know, more than half a million thus far have, you know, been treated by VA. And in addition to that, you know, we're seeing now, we're seeing estimates of more than 700,000 that will be suffering or, you know, to some extent many are suffering from PTSD and traumatic brain injury. Yet they can't get the relief that they need simply because, you know, things aren't being put into place. Mental health experts are not being hired. And you have to ask yourself, well, why? Why in Afghanistan, by the way? There was just a report. This is a report that, you know, should have been out on the front pages. Here we have in Afghanistan, you know, an army psychological unit that did, you know, that has been evaluating how the war is affecting our soldiers. You know, they found that there is, you know, a major uptick in psychological and mental health breakdown of our soldiers due to multiple deployments over mm-hmm. there. You know, and there's only 40, you know, mental health experts that are out there treating these soldiers. The Army right now is short 800. There's really no reason why they should be short, you know, 800, you know, mental health experts. And by the way, in addition to that, there's really no reason that the suicide rate this year will reach historic levels.
Mm-hmm.
And it only, you know, sort of, you know, this I have to say, it's sad, but goes toward the, you know, the rhetoric that has become something that I think people, particularly those on the left, are seeing from this administration.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of rhetoric about, you know, we want to change this and we want to change that, but action being taken to fix a broken system.
Well, and Jason, it's very interesting because the military unit, the Army Mental Health Advisory Team that conducted the survey in Afghanistan, came up with a percentage here that is strikingly close to the prediction of Michael Blecker. You cite him in your article.
Right.
And we interviewed him a couple of podcasts back. He's the executive director of the veterans group in San Francisco called Swords to Plowshares. And he said that he expects over 30% of the troops returning from Iraq and Afghanistan to present with either PTSD and or traumatic brain injury. And he split that pretty much in half. And so
right.
He's saying about 15% will have PTSD, and the screening committee is citing a number of 14% in Afghanistan in this recent survey.
Right.
So that jibes in a confirming way. And it's really sad that about the only bit of news coverage about a psychologist scheduled to go to Afghanistan is the excessive Islamophobic coverage of Dr. Hassan, the alleged shooter at Fort Hood.
That's right. You know, the problem is, Peter, is that nobody really cares about our veterans. And let's just face it. You know, we say we do. We certainly say that, you know, we honor their service. You know, we need to do a lot more for these folks who are suffering, who are on the third or fourth deployment. Fourth deployment. I mean, this is truly stunning. Paul Sullivan, who's the executive director for Veterans for Common Sense, you know, said that this administration, he called for this administration to, you know, immediately prepare to put some sort of game plan into place for, you know, how they're going to prepare for the, you know, returning veterans who are going to need, you know, mental health coverage for or treatment for PTSD. You know, the fact that they have to wait at least 6 months for benefits, that they're being sent, you know, back and forth to various facilities, that there is not an in-person evaluation being done when they return. I mean, that's part of the problem, is that we're sending people, you know, to war who are already suffering, but we're so short. By the way, so short on the number of soldiers that we have. I mean, we're using up every bit of resources that, you know, all of our resources in manpower, you know, to fight this.
And
there truly is no end in sight.
And Jason, you identified that Obama has put some good people like Shinseki and Duckworth at the Veterans Administration. But there's a guy named Ira Katz who is still there, the Deputy Chief Patient Care Services Officer. And tell us a little bit about him and about this email exchange that was discovered by CBS News.
Yeah, actually, this is pretty interesting. Ira Katz is somebody who was in place at the Veterans Administration during the Bush years. And, he was, but I should say that Paul Sullivan, who I just mentioned, his group had filed a lawsuit a couple of years ago to force the Veterans Administration and the Veterans Administration to immediately treat soldiers suffering from PTSD and to also make sure that their benefits are taken care of immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Ira Katz was somebody, this was, by the way, a lawsuit up in San Francisco that sought class action status. Ira Katz, is currently the Deputy Chief Patient Care Services Officer for the VA. He was identified in court last year as a person who was then the VA's mental health director. He had an email exchange with a woman named Ev Chasen over at the VA. She was the chief communications director. She had been contacted by CBS News, who was doing a story on veteran suicides, and she sent him an email that was under the subject line, not for the CBS News interview request.
Brilliant.
She sent him an email. That's actually not what she said in the subject line. That's what Ira Katz had sent back to her in response to an email that she sent saying, we're getting queries from CBS News about 18 suicides per day. Is that true? He sent her a response saying not for the CBS News interview request actually said in this email that the VA had identified 1,000 suicide attempts per month among war veterans treated by the VA, and that's all wars. In his body of his email, he wrote, our suicide prevention coordinators are identifying about 1,000 suicide attempts per month among the veterans we see in our medical facilities. Is this something we should carefully address ourselves in some sort of release before someone stumbles upon it? Basically, this is, what eventually came out is that, he was covering up this epidemic that was going on.
At minimum, it's damage control on an issue that is a matter of public concern and public record.
Right. And in addition to that, Bob Filner, congressman in San Diego, House Veteran Affairs Committee had called for, Ira Katz's ouster. But, here is, I have to say, we were surprised in this investigative report that I put together with another reporter at Truth Out that we were able to actually get him, to respond to our, to our interview request. And, what was surprising about that, Peter, was that he was still there. Here's a guy who literally should have just been, marched right out the door when the Obama administration was sworn into office, And what is he still doing there? Aside from the fact that he sits, he's telling us, hey, we've got this program and that program, and his remarks are truly, not very credible. I mean, they certainly, he's trying to, make it sound as if the VA is doing a lot, that he's certainly trying to, do a lot, but the facts state otherwise. So again, this really comes down to the Obama administration making nice. And, we see it certainly with, Robert Gates, who's still, Secretary of Defense,
mm-hmm.
and many, many, many other holdovers, the U.S. attorneys that, in some cases that are still in these positions.
Indeed.
And the problem with this is that, that it means that the red tape, still exists. It means that the old guard is still in place. And that's proven to be disastrous, as we've seen. I mean, I found it outrageous that the during a briefing a couple of weeks ago, that General Army General Peter Chiarelli, the Vice Chief of Staff of the Army, said that he sees a shortage of 750 to 800 mental health experts, and then goes on to say, this suicide epidemic is terrible. We've got to do something about it. And then you see, he's speaking to Ira Katz, who again cannot believe he's still there. Says, suicide, that's just an unfortunate sort of part of war, in a sense. I mean, I'm paraphrasing him, but more or less that's what he's saying. This is a very troubling situation. And Paul Sullivan, again, at Veterans for Common Sense, pointed out that what Shinseki and Obama need to do is they really need to clean house there. And some changes have been made, by the way, in the past few weeks. Admiral Patrick Dunn, he was the Undersecretary for Benefits for the VA since 2006. He resigned. That'll be effective next year. And he's somebody who oversaw this, massive benefits backlog, as well as many scandals involving the shredding of benefits at VA regional offices, and certainly the VA's mishandling of post 9/11 GI Bill benefits payments, again, it's just the bureaucratic red tape that exists that this administration is incredibly slow at cutting through, and it's unfortunate. It's taking a toll on the veterans in a fashion that, the public really needs to pay closer attention to. The media certainly needs to, jump on this further. I mean, it's sort of remarkable to me, Peter, that, here we have, 1.9 million, U.S. soldiers that have served, in war, and not really that many, front page stories about the, what happens when they return home.
Well, and this is something that we could put a dent in the number of suicides and the number of suicidal veterans if we would simply acknowledge this issue and build community-based programs to support these individuals at a very difficult time as they're trying to transition back into American society and culture.
Right.
And by not even talking about it, we consign these people to darkness and to the darkness of their experience and the clear depression that results when they return from a conflict such as the one in Afghanistan.
Yeah, exactly. And guess what? It's not happening. It didn't happen during the Bush administration. Certainly it was, they went out of their way, in a sense, to, sweep these facts and figures and under the rug, but here we have a president. I mean, this sort of reminds me, Peter, of a couple of things Obama did during his first days in office, literally his second day, signing this executive order, ushering in a new transparency, a new era of transparency in government. Okay, now he signed this executive order, made these great statements, but guess what? This administration has not even really lived up to that. If anything, on the third day, they were, citing state secrets privilege to block, the release of certain documents.
Mm-hmm.
Now, granted, certainly, this administration, allowed some things to be released. My point is that it's the same thing here. We have Obama last year making these statements on the campaign trail, about veterans. He certainly has moved to increase the VA's budget, which will, go a long way. But that's it. You got to follow through beyond that. And, I think that, he's going to find that, this is going to be the tough sledding unless he personally starts to weigh in on some of this. And certainly, Congress has tried to do many things, and I think that the VA certainly has that reputation of not not doing what, as good of a job as it can. But when we're talking about waging two wars, let's face it, we're waging two wars, and we've got hundreds of thousands of soldiers that are out there, and to not really make sure that when they return here that they're getting the proper care that they need is unbelievable.
I hope people will read this story. It's at truthout.org. We continue now with Jason Leopold. And, Jason, I want to turn to the piece that you wrote the day after Obama gave his staged speech at West Point, announcing that he was, after all, going to add 30,000 more troops in Afghanistan. And I have a clip here from the speech that I'd like to play as we begin a discussion about this.
Since then, we've made progress on some important objectives. High-ranking al-Qaeda and Taliban leaders have been killed, and we've stepped up the pressure on al-Qaeda worldwide. In Pakistan, that nation's army has gone on its largest offensive in years. In Afghanistan, we and our allies prevented the Taliban from stopping a presidential election. And although it was marred by fraud, that election produced a government that is consistent with Afghanistan's laws and constitution.
Now, this is just one excerpt from the speech, but in it, it identifies the extent to which Obama is embracing Bush's approach of using false choices and building on inaccurate or inappropriate premises. So he began the speech by invoking 9/11, by invoking the authority granted to the president, and he claimed it for himself, in the hastily passed resolutions that were, barely opposed. Only Barbara Lee, the congresswoman from Oakland, she cast the lone vote in the House and Senate against authorizing the president to have a blank check for an invasion of Afghanistan or to chase al-Qaeda people anywhere in the world. It was so
right.
Broadly written. And it was so frustrating for me to know that Barack Obama knows better, that he's a smart man, who knows that we're not just confronting 100 al-Qaeda people and the so-called Taliban, that there is an array of insurgent groups in Afghanistan and an even greater number of insurgent groups in Pakistan. And yet he dumbed it down and only talked about the boogeymen of al-Qaeda and Taliban. And then had the chutzpah, the balls, to say that, while the election was marred by fraud, that it's consistent with their constitution. Well, Karzai is not a legitimate ruler of that country.
No, he's not.
And that fuels the insurgency. Our expanded support of him only compounds that problem
right.
And enhances the role of the Taliban. And there are so many omissions from this speech that really was reduced to the same old talking points that Bush was hammering for 8 years.
Yeah, this was a remarkable speech, Peter, and I actually believe that this was a major turning point in Obama's presidency, one that will not serve him well, come 2012. I think historians will certainly say that. This sort of, again, rhetoric and gung-ho attitude of we will finish the job, we will win. History has proven otherwise in cases of other countries. So, what was truly stunning, and I have to say it's stunning because I that's exactly how I felt when I heard this speech, was hearing how quickly he invoked 9/11, and not just once, okay? Not just once, but many times, and he invoked 9/11 to justify what he is doing. And there's no other way to really cut around it. You can analyze it to death, but it's very simple. He is making a very unpopular decision catering or caving rather, to the generals, to the old Bush guard. He needs to justify that. And, the fact that he used 9/11, wow, that's, you know, that was something remarkable. And I think that, you know, the fact that he did, you know, cite a lot of the talking points, you know, that the Bush administration had used, I think that's part of the reason that people were so surprised and really now are very critical, is because we've heard this story before. And we did not expect it to hear it from this president. You know, look, he spoke very eloquently. You know, he pronounced nuclear correctly. Nuclear, I didn't pronounce it correctly just now. But he spoke well. But the fact is that, you know, do you recall when he said, hey, we're not doing this alone. We've got 43 nations.
Well, that's
kidding me, right? 43 nations? What, one soldier from Estonia?
Right, it's bullshit. And they are now double counting NATO troops who were sent there in advance of the August election. And now they're going to stay, but they're counting them as new troops.
Right.
As of January 1st, in an effort to try to distract us from the truth, which is that we're there pretty much alone, and that the forces from other countries, like Vladimir talked about, are confined to base. They are not out there circulating in the towns and in the rural areas and conducting patrols.
You know what else, Peter, is that what was stunning is that he actually, you know, tried to sell this as we need to escalate in order to end this war.
Right.
Okay? He cited July 2011. That was the talking points. By the way, I should also add that during the day, before his speech, I was on a call. The White House had a briefing for reporters with unnamed senior administration officials, and they were selling that. They were selling it as basically, you know, we need to escalate to end the war, July 2011 target date. But again, this is all based on conditions on the ground. There is absolutely, you know, he could remove one brigade and say, you know, we're starting to withdraw and end it. The fact of the matter is that, you know, Karzai just the other day Robert Gates was out there in Afghanistan, and Karzai saying, you know, we're going to need, you know, U.S. presence here for 15 to 20 years.
Well, he said the troop levels couldn't go down for at least 5 years, and the funding levels have to stay at least at the current level for 10 years.
Right.
So, Clinton, Gates, Petraeus, and General McChrystal have all backpedaled from Obama's floating of that July 2011 date. It's completely meaningless.
It's absolutely meaningless. And you know, and I think that's why I say that, you know, people should pay close attention to the fact of the date and time of this speech, because I think that that was the moment where certainly, you know, let's forget about the, you know, the folks that never supported him to begin with, but those that did, you know, his base, the progressive, you know, the masses that got him elected, I think have by and large turned their back on him because he's left them behind.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was very strange, I have to say, on the Sunday, just checking out the Sunday talk shows to see Hillary Clinton and Robert Gates together. You know, there was something very strange, something, you know, too familiar, you know, about you're seeing somebody from the last administration who was, you know, in place during, you know, much of the bloodshed and talks of escalating, you know, in Iraq. And, you know, here he is again. And, you know, what I walked away with, or what resonated with me, is that there really isn't much change there. Now, I should actually add that, you know, Obama did say on the campaign trail, you know, that this was the, you know, the right war, the good war, Afghanistan, that is. And, you know, that was the campaign trail. A lot has changed since then, Peter, as you know, from the campaign trail to where we are right now with Afghanistan. The elections are certainly, you know, a very important, you know, point to focus on the corruption in that government. And here we are just, you know, he's saying that we're not going to give him a blank check, but you know, well, when does it stop? You know, the hardest decision that Obama could have made is to actually say, I'm not going to send any more troops to Afghanistan until this government, you know, gets its shit in order.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or cleans it up, rather. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, he took so much time on this decision when the whole time he was, what was he contemplating?
Well, and it's clear the New York Times did a fascinating postmortem on the decision-making process, and it showed that in October, Obama ruled out a withdrawal. All right. So
right.
The all the options, all of this open-ended discussion that he was engaged in did not include the most important option that I believe should have been evaluated and should have been implemented.
Right.
And Jason, the other thing that deeply troubled me in this speech is that he has finally capitulated to the corporate media conventional wisdom that the Iraq surge worked. And
this is
not just a myth, it is a flat-out lie.
It is a lie.
And I have in front of me David Sanger of the New York Times, his analysis column from Saturday, December 5th.
Right.
And he says the commonalities of two surges mask their crucial differences.
Yeah.
Well, he makes some interesting points in the second half of his argument, but he begins by once again affirming the lie that the surge worked simply because President Bush dispatched 30,000 more troops.
Right.
It's much more complicated than that. They never mentioned the partitioning, the ethnic cleansing that has been underway to separate Sunnis from Shiites in Iraq, and many other factors that contributed to a short-term reduction in violence, but it has not been sustained except from the narrow prism of American troop fatalities. November was the lowest month since we invaded Iraq. Only two Americans died.
Right.
But the car bombings continue. The suicide bombings continue. 175 people were killed just in the past few days in a series of five car bombings near Baghdad. And so that he would finally and so fully embrace the myth of the Iraq surge working only to facilitate the selling of this new surge in Afghanistan is insulting to me, and it's tragic to see this president. And I agree with you that this is a turning point. I think that this does sadly put him on a track to be a one-term president.
I really think it does, and you know, unless. And you know, unless something changes in terms of, and I think that'll have to do with quickness and changing and for the better. I think that's it. Because let's face it, on some of the most important, you know, issues that he has been undertaking, you know, healthcare, Afghanistan. Torture. This administration has capitulated to, you know, the Republicans,
mm-hmm.
And you know, to you know, the bureaucracy. You know, healthcare. At first, it was, you know, we came down from a single payer to a public option, now to a, you know, what does he want? He wants to get something through. That's
yeah.
it.
Yeah, just okay. a fig leaf. Anything
just
will be
get
fine.
Get me something through so I can wave it up, wave it around, and say, you know, we overhauled health, you know, the healthcare system, you know, look, you know, I think that, you know, he talked about, you know, on Afghanistan. Well, we're you know, as if it were, you know, we should celebrate this or something. We're escalating there, but we're drawing down troops from Iraq. You know, it's. We're talking about war, a war that's been going on for 8 years, and granted that the Bush administration neglected Afghanistan, you know, he came in and, you know, Obama saying in a speech, you know, when I got into office, there were 32,000 troops, and guess what? We're going to have 100,000.
Plus 100,000 contractors that
exactly.
we don't talk about.
Exactly. So,
and Jason, to finish on this Sanger analysis piece in the New York Times,
yeah.
buried toward the end, he acknowledges the real problems, that you can't compare the way we bought off the Sunni Awakening movement in Anbar province with our ability to buy off people in Afghanistan. He says, what's more, in Afghanistan, the extremists, the Taliban, are natives. They're
right.
part of the furniture. They've always been there. And this, we've just learned this week that we have been allowing the Karzai government to underpay the troops in the army and the officers in the police force. They get paid much less than their
right.
Taliban counterparts.
Right.
Now, that's
exactly.
one of the fundamentals of market-driven militarism.
Yeah.
that
and,
you...
and by the way, let me just also say that we cannot forget the fact that, you know, you've got a prison, Bagram over in Afghanistan,
mm-hmm.
and now we know that there are still, you know, these highly secretive prisons operating as well under this administration.
Right.
You know, where... detainees are being tortured.
And Jason, in a recent interview with a fascinating man named Pepe Escobar, who
yeah.
is a globetrotting journalist for the Asia Times,
right.
he alleged that there are as many as 10,000 people being detained in and around Bagram. The official number we're told is between 900 and 1,000. And I haven't been able to find a second source to confirm that, but Pepe is a very reliable reporter.
Yeah.
And so that's something that bears further scrutiny.
Sure.
But,
and Obama, you know, what he's doing, you know, his administration is doing is they're clamping down. They don't want any of these details to come out. It's all secret.
Well, and let's touch on that a moment, because there was a fascinating issue that floated this week. The John Conyers, who is one of the leading progressives in the House, and I think the second senior member, he's been there the second longest. He heads the Judiciary Committee, and he got an unexpected phone call from the president recently saying, "Why are you demeaning me?"
Yeah.
And Conyers has gone out of his way to differ with the president as politely as he could, to mute some of his objections to this escalation in Afghanistan and on other issues, and for Obama to, you know, put the squeeze on a guy like Conyers who has tried so hard not to make it personal, not to attack the president, but to attack policies. It shows the way Obama has shut down any kind of debate within his own party.
Absolutely, and I think that it was, you know, the exchange with Conyers, I mean, again, wow, stunning, because, you know, this is clearly, you know, a president who recalls how, you know, recent it was that he was, you know, in the Senate, and I don't think that he, you know, is used to this type of criticism. You know, I should say that, you know, what's very interesting is that Obama had, over the summer, I believe it was, could have been a little bit earlier, but he had a meeting with human rights organizations. Okay, the you know, officials from human rights organizations. This was a, you know, sort of off the record background type meeting, and he actually said the same thing to them. Okay, and he said to these folks, you know, at the ACLU, Human Rights Watch, "Why are you criticizing me? You know, criticizing what I'm doing in the media." If you go back and look and see the similarities between, you know, what he has said to Conyers and you know, what he's saying here. And, you know, I think that he's, in a way, it seems as if he's, you know, is he that much in the dark by not seeing why? You know, Conyers dealing with the Patriot Act is just a perfect example of showing how, you know, Obama is, you know, nothing but a contradiction.
Yeah.
And
now, Jason, this is the perfect time to ask you about this conference call that you were on earlier today
with
representatives of the American Civil Liberties Union. And apparently they have tired of politeness, and they're going to be much more blunt in confronting this president over his shortcomings on legal issues, including detention, torture, and hopefully
right.
wiretapping. I'm inserting that because I care about it. I'm not sure if it was on the agenda.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because one of the things that they did mention in terms of wiretapping on this phone call is that they have, you know, tried to get access to the Office of Legal Counsel memos that were written regarding the, you know, authorization to, you know, to tap into phones, emails, electronic communication domestically. And, you know, certainly they were, you know, the Bush administration thwarted their efforts, but, you know, what they're saying is that this administration, the Obama administration, has gone even further on that particular issue, by the way, despite the fact that their own inspector generals, you know, issued a report earlier this year citing the very memos that they were seeking. So, you know, this was a call, a briefing, with, you know, with reporters, in which the ACLU, this was a withering indictment of the Obama administration, of President Obama, and what they are not doing in terms of accountability, prosecution for, or at least investigating and prosecuting torture. In fact, they brought up the, you know, the Freedom of Information Act executive order that Obama signed. The ACLU said, by and large, we have seen absolutely no impact by that order. In terms of more transparency, you know, let's not forget that the memos that were released earlier this year that gave us quite a bit of insight into, you know, the Bush administration's use of torture and how it developed, that was a matter of a lawsuit. You know, that was a judge saying, you know, you got to release these things. But in terms of, you know, Obama saying, presume that, you know, we should be an open book, that has not been the case. You know, the ACLU basically, you know, basically said that you know, Obama is, you know, more or less what he's doing now is putting into place a sweeping immunity doctrine, you know, for Bush administration torturers.
Well, including John Yoo, and we've seen that gratuitously, the Justice Department has filed a brief supporting John Yoo's contention that he was giving advice to the president and therefore is covered by some bizarre expansion of executive privilege. Yoo was not a direct advisor to the president. He was working at the Justice Department. His,
right.
His memos certainly went to the White House, but they weren't even addressed to Bush.
Right. And by the way, let me just say that John Yoo has a private attorney at this point. I believe the attorney, Miguel Estrada, is being paid for by taxpayer dollars.
That's true.
Okay. However, he's a private attorney, meaning that in the case, certainly, you know, with Jose Padilla, he does not, the Justice Department does not represent John Yoo. In this particular issue that you just brought up, the Justice Department, the Obama Justice Department, went out of their way to file a friend of the court brief basically saying that, you know, you got to dismiss this lawsuit and, you know, dismiss this case. And in addition to that, there's no recourse for people like Jose Padilla at all. You know, our folks are held to a much lower standard than regular folk like you and me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's more or less what this says. They said that, you know, in this brief that, look, there's remedies for, you know, for these annoying little things like authorizing torture. And we've got the, you know, a Justice Department watchdog report by the Office of Professional Responsibility that's looking into it. Let them deal with it. Just, you know, sweep this thing aside and dismiss it. And that's truly what this, you know, what this said. Of course, that report, you know, again, has not only been watered down, but
it's been overdue for months, and they just they promised it to us in November.
Yeah, and I actually spoke to Tracy Schmaller, who's a spokesperson at the DOJ, on Friday, last Friday, and, you know, keep in mind that this is their official line. They're not going to tell me anything on the record that certainly strays from that. But she said, "Oh no, the review process is almost complete. It's not delayed, should be out soon." My understanding is, and I spoke to also, you know, Miguel Estrada about this, at least asking him about it, my understanding is that the final version of the report, the final version, once again was shared with the people that were under investigation, John Yoo, Jay Bybee, who's now over at the Ninth Circuit,
mm-hmm.
Steve Bradbury, and that John Yoo, through his attorney Miguel Estrada, had once again issued more responses to it. I mean, this administration, Peter, has gone above and beyond, okay, more so than the Bush administration. Because with the Bush administration, it was, you know, basically, delay, say national security to some extent. But what this administration is doing, okay, is that they're actually coming up with new legal theories. You know, the cooking up new legal theories as to why, cases like this not only should be dismissed, but, legal theories in terms of, blocking memos, and we're seeing it more and more this year. And, you know, they made a very good point on this call today. And like I said, it was powerful. This was a group that really, applauded Obama earlier in the year, but, they took the gloves off here. But where, they made a point by saying, this is not going away. Their lawsuits are not going away. The issue of torture in the previous administration is not going away. In fact, there is going to be more documents coming out this month. By the way, we just had, hundreds upon hundreds of new documents that were released within the past month that once again show that the Bush administration knew was far more involved than they ever let on, and particularly with the issue regarding the destruction of these torture tapes, that the White House, the Bush White House, was consulted about that. That was part of this new information. So each time we see new evidence just piling up, that where the narrative, you're able to piece together a very good narrative as to who knew what and when. And that you have a president here. By the way, today, Peter, December 10th, is World Human Rights Day.
Yeah.
So you have Obama today in accepting the Nobel Peace Prize, talking about, human rights to some extent. And so the ACLU made this point that, and I don't think that the day that they chose their call was what happened to be a coincidence. I think it was, timed to basically say enough is enough, not allow him to have this brief moment of celebration with the Nobel Peace Prize, but to say enough is enough. You're actually, what you're doing now is actually worse than what the last administration has done, because you're going out of your way to make sure that nobody is ever held accountable. You listen to it, Peter, and it's like you said, it's really sad, because I actually was just recently watching the documentary about that Ed Norton, the actor, had put together about Obama, how he became president, from the start to the finish, when his campaign started to the very end. And you watch that now, and I don't want to go. I don't want to become too dramatic in saying he's, the worst thing at all. But there, things are far different now than what we had hoped for or expected them to be.
Indeed. Well, Jason, thank you for this excellent report, and we certainly will continue to support the ACLU's efforts to return constitutional governance to these shores.
Yes. Thank you, Peter.
Jason Leopold, truthout.org, here on the Peter B. Collins Show. Thanks for listening to this edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Your feedback is welcome. Email me, peter@peterbcollins.com. Happy trails.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.